You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, we talk about the golden age of Las Vegas entertainment with author Richard Zoglin. His great new book is called Elvis in Vegas. Of course, Elvis Presley had a long association with Las Vegas. He made one of his most admired films, Viva Las Vegas, there. He married Priscilla there, and he partied there on his off time after wrapping up a film. And he made a triumphant return to live performing there in 1969. Elvis also performed there in 1956, the year of his meteoric rise to stardom, in what was considered a rare misstep in that pivotal year in the King's career. Let's begin by listening to Elvis performing before a polite crowd that did not know what to make of him at the Frontier Hotel in 1956.
It's really been a pleasure being in Las Vegas. This makes our second week here. Tonight's our last night, and we've had a pretty hard time. Had a pretty good time while we're here. And we got a few little songs we'd like to do for you. We have on record, and our style of singing, if you want to call it singing. And here's one that I hope you like. And this one really tells a story, friends. It's not only sad, it's plumb pitiful. Plumb pitiful.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street at Heartbreak Hotel, where I'll be so lonely, baby. Well, I am so lonely. Well, I am so lonely, I could die.
Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom.
Be so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely, they could die.
Well, hops just keep flowing, and the desk clerk's dressed in black. Well, they've been so long on Lonely Street,
they'll never look back. And they're so lonely, baby. Well, they're so lonely. Well, they're so lonely, and they could die.
Heartburn Motel.
Well, you'll be so lonely, baby. Well, you'll be lonely.
That was a little bit of Elvis Presley's Las Vegas debut in 1956. The late 50s and early 60s were the years when Las Vegas was dominated by Frank Sinatra and the Rat Pack. Here's Sinatra at the Sands in Las Vegas in 1961.
You make me feel so young. You make me feel that spring has sprung. And every time I see you grin, I'm such a happy individual. The moment that you speak, I wanna go play hide and seek. I wanna go and bounce the moon just like a toy balloon. You and I, we're just like a couple of tots running across a meadow, picking up lots of forget-me-nots. Because you make me feel so young. You make me feel there are songs to be sung, bells to be rung, and a wonderful fling to be flung. And even when I'm old and gray, I'm gonna feel the way I do today. 'Cause you make me feel so young.
That was Frank Sinatra at his Las Vegas peak in 1961. By the end of that decade, Sinatra and his cronies were growing passé in the era of flower children and Woodstock. But Elvis Presley returned to Vegas in 1969 to great acclaim.
New record just came out, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you like it. It's called Suspicious Minds.
We're caught in a trap. I can't walk out because I love you too much, baby. Why can't you see?
Was Elvis Presley performing at the International Hotel in Las Vegas in 1969. My guest on From the Bookshelf tonight is Richard Zoglin. He's the author of the definitive biography of Bob Hope, Hope, Entertainer of the Century. Richard Zoglin also wrote Comedy on the Edge, How Stand-Up in the 1970s Changed America. His new book is called Elvis in Vegas, How the King Reinvented the Las Vegas Show. Richard Zoglin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be with you.
Your new book has as much about Sinatra as it does about Elvis, but you use Elvis' first appearance in 1956 and his return in 1969 as the frame for your narrative. So tell us, how did Las Vegas evolve in those years?
Well, first of all, I originally kind of wanted to do a book about Vegas' golden age of entertainment in the 60s, from the Rat Pack show in January 1960 to Elvis's comeback show in 69. It seemed to perfectly frame the 60s, and which I think really were the high point of years of Vegas's entertainment heyday. But as I kind of got into it, I saw that, you know, how much connection Elvis had with Las Vegas. I mean, at the beginning, I wasn't even aware that he had played Vegas in 56, and that he continued to have this connection with Vegas, you know, kept coming back for just R&R, and it was his favorite getaway, and he made Viva Las Vegas there, and he married Priscilla there, etc. So it just seemed like combining Elvis and Vegas, there were two sort of parallel narratives, and so that's how it kind of became a book both about Elvis and about Vegas. But how did Vegas change in those years? You know, in the early 60s, with the Rat Pack kind of sparking the heyday years, I would say, Vegas was the coolest place, you know, in the world for entertainment, and everybody played there, and it was the heyday of the nightclub show. And then as the 60s went along, as we all know, the culture changed, and the Beatles came along, and the counterculture, and Vietnam, etc., and by the end of the 60s, Vegas was not so cool anymore, and the Rat Pack guys were getting old, and the younger groups, the Beatles and all the rock groups of the era, were not coming to Vegas. The younger generation was, you know, not interested in Vegas. And so Vegas was really starting to flounder a little bit, trying to figure out what to do to stay relevant. And I just thought it was very fitting that they came upon the original rock and roller, Elvis, at a time when he needed a boost to his career, and Elvis became the iconic Vegas star and kind of brought rock and roll to Vegas and opened up a new kind of Vegas show, I would say.
Well, have you ever given any thought to why the 60s are such an impactful decade and why so much happened and so many things evolved so quickly during that short period?
Wow, you know, I think about that a lot. It seems like I lived through the 60s, and every single year had a different personality, almost. I don't know, maybe it's just my age, but I couldn't tell you from 2000 to 2010 what happened each of those years. But something about that decade, just such ferment and so many changes and in so many different fields, you know. I mean, the summer of 69... This summer, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Woodstock and the moon landing and the Tate LaBianca murders. I mean, it was quite, as well as Elvis's Vegas comeback. So,
and of course, Richard Nixon's comeback, too.
Yeah, well, that too. But so, I don't know. But, you know, of course, the 60s just were a unique decade.
I don't know if it's important to be a fan of the stuff that you're writing about, but I can tell, because when you write about Presley or Sinatra, you have listened intently to all of the recordings. But was that just research, or are you a fan of Elvis? Did you ever see him?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I was kind of a mild fan of Elvis. I mean, but not a particular aficionado. So I did a lot of listening, and I really tried to analyze what made him so good. In the case of Sinatra, I was a fan again, but I really think, you know, it's hard to write about music, but I try very hard. I'm not really a music critic, but you know, I think I have a good ear, and I just try to listen over and over again and try to see what makes these singers distinctive and you know, what makes them so great. I did find listening to Elvis, listening to all of his stuff, his Vegas stuff and his earlier stuff, that he just impressed me more and more as a singer. Just, you know, what a voice he had, and his interpretations of songs. I think when he did covers of other people's songs, I think in a lot of cases he did them better. He was great. And, you know, talk about Sinatra too. I could see what made him so terrific early in his career. I found some of the later stuff not so good. I thought the live Vegas stuff was really exciting, particularly in the early 60s and the great Basie album. So I just try to, it's a challenge to convey, you know, music to a reader, you know, the sound, but I tried real hard.
It's interesting that Elvis, who made his name in rock and roll, although he was obviously a fan of Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and all those guys, he could easily sing songs like Harbor Lights or, you know, Are You Lonesome Tonight, which was originally an Al Jolson record, I think.
Yeah.
And yet when Sinatra tried to do Love Me Tender or a Beatles song, it's terrible. It's awful.
Yeah, that's true. Elvis, that's one of the great things about him. He showed so much versatility when he came back to Vegas. And, you know, to the purists of rock and roll who think that Elvis never did anything good after the 50s, and I know people like that, you know, who just think the classic Elvis is the only Elvis. Well, you know, to the purest rock and roll critics, that might be true, because he certainly was not the sort of transgressive rock and roller in the 60s, in the late 60s and 70s, as he was in the 50s. But he you know, really reinvented himself in a really, I think, brave way. And he wanted to sing to everybody. He wanted to sing the rock and roll. The rock and roll that he loved, he sang. And yet he wasn't afraid to do a sentimental, you know, ballad like Memories, or In the Ghetto, and you know, a song like In the Ghetto, I think it's, you know, when you think about a white guy singing that song, it could sound really phony, and sometimes people think it is, but boy, what a great vocal performance. I mean, it's just a great song, and you know, it's a powerful song. So Elvis, you know, he could do everything too. He could do country, he could do gospel, he could do the big ballads, and I think he had more range than Frank Sinatra. So I was very impressed.
In that way, he was like Bing Crosby. I mean, Bing did Irish music, country music, Hawaiian music. And Bing was the one in your book who spotted Elvis right away as a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, that was Shecky Green told me that story, that in 56 when Elvis was at the New Frontier Hotel on a bill with Shecky Green, and the crowd didn't really know what to make of Elvis in those days. Elvis was just coming up. And Shecky didn't really know what to make of him either, or at least he didn't think he was Vegas. But he was standing there. Apparently Bing Crosby was in town watching Elvis, and Bing said to Shecky, he's going to be the biggest thing in show business. Wow. So, yeah. People like that can recognize.
In a way, Bing Crosby and Elvis Presley did the same thing, which was take African-American popular music and make it white popular music.
Yes, and they both transitioned somewhat from, you know, at the beginning, Bing was more of a straight jazz singer, and as the years went on and he became kind of America's singer, you know, he was more middle of the road, sentimental, kind of straight, you know, square kind of, you know, and Elvis too got more commercial, more mainstream, and that bothered some of his, you know, older, his former, you know, fans. But he drew a much broader audience and showed much greater versatility and the ability to put across all sorts of songs.
And those two guys died in the same, I don't know, like a month apart in 1977.
Well, you know what? That just struck me. I didn't really think about that. So, yeah, right, yeah. 77.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Richard Zoglin. His new book is called Elvis in Vegas, How the King Reinvented the Las Vegas Show. Tell us a little bit about the rise of Las Vegas.
Oh, well, you know, I didn't want to do a whole history, but you have to kind of talk about the origins, and it's very interesting how it began. Really, Vegas began as a kind of tourist spot. It was 1931 when gambling was legalized in the state of Nevada, and the construction began on Hoover Dam. So the huge public works project and all these thousands of workers coming to nearby Boulder City and they looking for something to do and spend their money on Saturday night. So the downtown hotels and casinos of Vegas was where they went. Then the first strip hotel was the El Rancho Vegas in 1941. The Last Frontier came a year later, and then it was the Flamingo, of course, at the end of 46, which really was the glamour capital of Vegas for most of the rest of the 40s. The biggest stars were there. Jimmy Durante opened the hotel, and so that was really the hotel that really launched the big stars coming to Vegas. And then, of course, the all the classic strip hotels followed. And boy, you know, by the 50s, it was the entertainment capital and getting pretty much all the big, nightclub stars. I felt like, though, that the Rat Pack show in 60 just took it to a new level. Also, other things were happening. In the 50s, it was still hard for people from the East Coast to get to Las Vegas. You know, there weren't transcontinental flights. So their clientele was still mostly West Coast and maybe Texas, you know. And it really took the kind of nonstop jet service, which began in 1960. And also the rise of television, which was interesting. In the early 50s, you know, television was becoming a factor, but still only a percentage of the country had television. By 1960, almost everyone had television. And that was important because television created Vegas stars. Television is blamed for the demise of nightclubs, I think, because people just didn't want to go out to their local nightclub when they could stay in and watch TV and see bigger stars on their home screen. But for Vegas, TV introduced new kind of talent that people knew instantly. Stars of TV sitcoms could come out to Vegas and have Phil Silvers or somebody. And then later in the 60s, Johnny Carson. The idea of Johnny Carson becoming a big Vegas star, I think some people were probably pretty skeptical. He was not a nightclub performer, he just was a TV star. And so it just seemed like with the Rat Pack in 1960 and then all this other stuff going on, wow, those first few years of the 60s to me were the peak years of Vegas. I kind of cited one, I just picked a month at random, or a week at random in 1964, just to go around the strip and see who you could see, at the various hotels. And it was just an amazing array of, from Ray Bolger to Maurice Chevalier to, it was just an amazing array of celebrities any given week in Vegas. So that was, to me, the kind of peak years.
I was really interested in all of the acts that you discussed, and I did a little hunting so I could hear some of them. I'd never heard of the Mary Kay Trio, but they were very influential.
Yeah, I hadn't either, actually. They were an interesting group, very 50s. They had that sort of close harmony sound. But they were apparently, and this you can't tell from the recordings, but apparently in the lounge they were really an exciting act. They had, it was a trio, and one of them, Frank Ross, was a kind of a comedian, and he would sort of ad-lib, and very loose and fun, and kind of defined what Vegas lounge entertainment would become. So, they were very influential.
Tell me a little bit about the lounge. What was the difference between the lounge and the showroom?
Yeah, well, the lounges were just sort of small bar areas originally adjacent to the casino, and the idea was they were originally just they might have some music there, but it was just supposed to be accompaniment for the casino, just, you know, some musical accompaniment. Then starting with Mary Kay, really, the idea that they would be an act in itself, and that they would their shows would be in between the showroom, the main showroom shows. So the idea was that would keep people in the hotel, in the casino. They'd finish with the showroom, and they'd go into and they'd see there's a lounge show. So it kept people. It was a way of keeping people in the hotel, and they were much more casual. You could come and go much easier, looser, more ad-libby kind of audience involvement, more smaller venues, and you know, so perfect for guys like Shecky Green and Don Rickles, and singers too. Also, the lounges were able to experiment a little more with music. Rock and roll and R&B were not really for the main showroom, but they, quite a few R&B acts did play the lounges. And early rock and rollers, like a group that I'd never heard of, all but forgotten today, the Trinneers, were kind of forerunners of rock and roll, and they were playing the lounge. They were very big in the lounge in the 50s. And then in the 60s, Sonny Charles was big, and R&B kind of groups. So the lounges were a little more experimental, a little more intimate, and more fun, I think.
Who was it who brought Hound Dog to Elvis's attention?
Yeah, there was a group called Freddie Bell and the Bell Boys, who were kind of, you know, nightclubby type rock and roll group. I mean, they were doing rocking kind of songs, but they were dressed in suits and choreographed, you know, kind of slick nightclub type of act. But they picked up a song that Big Mama Thornton had sung a couple years before, had recorded and been fairly successful with, Hound Dog. Elvis goes to see them in the lounge, and he loved that song, and he basically took it for his act. And doing the same kind of rocked-up version, but even more so. It's interesting because I've heard Freddie Bell's version, and then we all know Elvis's, the recorded version of Hound Dog, which is a little different, better, you know. But in between, Elvis started, before he recorded it, he started performing it on stage, and I've heard a couple recordings, and it sounds more like Freddie Bell's version. In other words, he was kind of gradually making it his own, but when he first started doing it, he was basically doing Freddie Bell's version.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So not Big Mama Thornton's version, which is completely different.
No. They both took that sort of blues song and turned it into a rock and roll song. Freddie Bell's version was just a little more slick, and Elvis's had more rock soul or something in it. Anyway, it's a great, you know, that Hound Dog became his really his kind of signature hit, I'd say, of all his 50s hits. And, you know, I love that record. That just as a recording, the original Hound Dog, it's not a very good song. I mean, I never quite made sense of the song, but the recording is great. The accompaniment, the backup singers, the guitar, everything, and Elvis's performance.
Right. When Big Mama Thornton sings it, it makes sense because she's singing to this man who's...
Yeah, right.
Right. But it doesn't make sense for Elvis to be singing it.
You ain't nothing but a hound. It's supposed to be sung by a woman. It makes no sense.
What about Louis Prima and Keeley Smith?
Oh, wow. They are... you know, I knew about them, but I didn't know how big they were. They were just probably the biggest Vegas lounge act ever. He was... You know, he had a band, and she was the singer. Louis played the trumpet, but they had such a high-energy act, a quirky act, because Keeley had this kind of deadpan. She was the singer, and when she wasn't singing, she just had this kind of deadpan manner, and they kind of played on that. Louis was really high-energy and crazy and funny, and he would kind of bait her. But musically, they were great too. I mean, their jazz recordings are great. Sam Butera on trombone, and Bobby Morris was a drummer. Anyway, it was a great group, and she was a great singer, and they were just you know, on fire in the lounge. Everybody just they packed the room all the time, and everyone says they were just the most exciting lounge act ever.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking tonight with Richard Zoglin. His new book is called Elvis in Vegas, How the King Reinvented the Las Vegas Show. So let's talk a little bit about Sinatra and the Rat Pack. They did shows, how many shows a night? And they did a show like at 3 a.m. or something, right?
They did. They may have done a couple shows. It was mainly a dinner show and a midnight show. I think they may have done a couple of, you know, late. A lot of times the performers on their last night would do an extra late show for the other performers. It was basically two shows a night. And, you know, the idea of five guys of that stature getting on the stage every night was, you know, pretty amazing for Vegas. That was a show that really, you know, broke all attendance records at the time. It got so much buzz. Celebrities came to see him. Jack Kennedy came to see him. When you see them, and that is, by the way, the Rat Pack shows are among the few, very few Vegas shows that you can actually see. I mean, there was some video recording, filming, I guess. So you can see some of their shows. Most other, you know, they didn't film Vegas shows back then, so... Maybe you can hear recordings if they did audio recordings, but seeing them is hard. Seeing the Rat Pack, actually seeing them today is a little bit of a letdown, or a little bit possibly disturbing. You know, there's a lot of racial humor. Boy, politically incorrect, man. This is stuff they could never get away with today. And also a lot of just foolishness. But musically, it was fantastic. And to have three guys, I mean, leave aside Lawford and Joey Bishop, the three musical guys were just at the top of their game, and you know, great. So to get that confluence of talent on one stage in one night, wow, I can see why it was so exciting.
When I watch, I maybe I'm just projecting, but sometimes I think that Sinatra is a little annoyed when the clowning around interferes with his singing. He wants to do his set without their...
Yeah, yeah. Well, Sinatra's ego is pretty apparent, and they all kind of... They actually make a joke of it. They call him, you know, the leader, and they make jokes about defending the leader, and Sinatra eats it up. And, you know, it's tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, nothing is ever totally tongue-in-cheek. The jokes always have a little... bit of truth behind them, so and some of it's, you know, bothers me watching it, but you know, I totally understand why it was so big.
Oh, I mean, the sexism, the racism, and the and misogynism, the anti-gay stuff, it's pretty hard to watch now.
Yeah it is. And the you know, Sammy, the black guy, black and Jewish, just constantly, you know, it was all in fun. They were making fun of Sammy and all that, and he played along, but, you know, at some point, just kind of went over the line, and you kind of wonder why Sammy put up with it. And I think that he, you know, under, even though he played along and smiled and joked along with him, I think he wasn't so happy about it, because there were times when it sort of came out, his resentment against Sinatra.
Well, you know, I guess there's two schools of thought. One is that, you know, we're more enlightened and we don't tolerate that kind of thing. And at the same time, well, maybe we should have more of a sense of humor and not be so uptight about it all.
Yeah, well, look, I generally agree with that. You know, I think today, you know, the political correctness thing has gone a little too far, and comedy is its own thing. If it was good comedy, I think some of the Rat Pack stuff was just pretty juvenile. You know, frat boy, not even frat boy, sort of high school humor. So, but, you know, I don't want to, you know, it was a great show. I mean, they musically it was, you know, pretty spectacular. And just the idea that you were seeing these big stars on the stage and they were cracking jokes and talking like regular people. I mean, you really got a sense of them as real people. And it wasn't a packaged, slick, you know, Vegas show. It was kind of a rowdy free-for-all. And, you know, that was just a lot of fun.
Well, I know that Bing Crosby actually. Oh, Bing lived in Palm Springs, but I know that Durante played Vegas and some of those greats, and a lot of the people you mentioned in the book. But what about Bob Hope? Did Bob Hope ever come to Vegas?
You know, Bob Hope, he came to Vegas, but he was one of the only big stars at the time who never did a Vegas engagement. He felt he was on a plane of his own. There was everybody else, and there was Bob Hope. And I think he only, what I heard when I was writing my Bob Hope book was that he only wanted to play Vegas if he would get paid more than anybody else. And by the time he was saying that, other people were getting a lot of money, and you know, people weren't so sure that Bob Hope was really a Vegas performer, so he didn't get what he wanted. He also, you know, Bob Hope wanted, he always wanted, when he made deals, he wanted to, you know, sell off his property. Part of his salary would be, you buy some of my property. And I don't think the hotels were into that. but Bob was in and out of Vegas quite a bit. He was on stage for one of the Rat Pack shows. They called him up out of the audience. He came up and did a few wisecracks and, you know, took part, as a lot of the comedians.
Well, I know Jack Benny played Vegas quite regularly.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised. I didn't know that Jack. I didn't realize Jack Benny was so much of a Vegas person. And he would do. He and George Burns both did Vegas shows that were kind of variety shows a little more. I mean, they would introduce a lot of new acts, young acts, and a lot of people got their start on those shows. I mean, well, Jack Benny, one of his, when he was touring, one of his opening acts was Wayne Newton. And then George Burns famously introduced Anne Margaret when she was back in 1960, you know, years before she became a big Hollywood star. So those guys, yeah, all the old-timers, Milton Berle did Vegas. The comedians who were coming along, the younger ones, you know, Bob Newhart, Shelley Berman, even Woody Allen played Vegas in the later 60s, which is kind of hard to imagine.
And, of course, that great stage comedian Ronald Reagan had a played
yes.
Vegas.
Well, that was back in the 50s when, in the 50s, I think Vegas became a good place for Hollywood stars who had a name and a profile, but their careers were kind of starting to fade. Their Hollywood careers were kind of on the downslope. It was a good play. They could come, you know, put together a Vegas show. And Reagan was one of them. Wasn't a very good show, but, you know, he did something on the stage. You know, odd people played Vegas. You know, Marlena Dietrich did a Vegas show. Even Noel Coward did a Vegas show.
He was big. He was very successful there, if I recall.
Yeah, yeah. And lesser Hollywood stars like Esther Williams, when she was, you know, no longer makes movies, was doing.
Did they have a big swimming pool on stage?
No, I don't think so. You know, they a lot. You know, Betty Grable. Oh, you know, all the sort of stars from the 40s. By the time when they were getting a little too old for the movie tickets, so. Do you know Vegas, or you know Debbie Reynolds? Of course, was still, you know, pretty close to her prime when she started doing Vegas. Did a lot of Vegas, so it was a big spot for Hollywood stars.
I saw Sammy Davis Jr. in Las Vegas in about 1969 or 70, and he was amazing. One of the greatest things I've ever seen. The room was quite small, and he was in the center. There was like a you know, in the round. But his little stage was pretty small. And I don't think there were that many people in the room. And everybody was smoking, including Sammy. There was like a blue smoke. But when Elvis played, he played to a tremendously huge audience.
Right. The International Hotel, it was just opening. And it was the biggest hotel in Vegas, across from the convention center. And it was had the biggest show on it, twice as big as any other room in Vegas, 2,000 seats, a balcony, the first showroom in Vegas to have a balcony. So Elvis, and so his show was different. It was not an intimate nightclub type of show, a Rat Pack type of show. It was a big, you know, rock concert-like extravaganza. And that was something, you know, new to Vegas. And that's, I think, you know, the beginning of how, you know, Vegas started to change. Elvis not only, you know, the biggest show that Vegas had seen, but it was also a different kind of audience, you know. He brought in a much broader middle American audience. You know, Elvis fans from all over the country would come to see his shows. They weren't necessarily Vegas people. They were, maybe they'd never been to Vegas before, but they came for Elvis. They maybe weren't big gamblers, but they came and they went to, you know, maybe they'd go to four or five shows of Elvis. They'd go every night. But it was, I think that was the beginning of the sort of change that started to come over Vegas from the transition from an, you know, nightclub, a gambling town for adults, to a theme park vacation mecca for the whole family. The later, you know, theme park hotels, Cirque du Soleil, and eventually the new residencies, the Celine Dion's and Jennifer Lopez and Lady Gaga, are all doing shows. I think Elvis is with the first of those kind of shows. Now, they... much more production. Elvis's show had very little actual production. It wasn't, you know, a sound and light show, or didn't have too much going on except for Elvis. But still, the idea of bringing rock and roll onto the big stage, bringing a huge collection of musicians. You know, you had a backup band, two backup singing groups, male and female, and you know, more than 40 pieces in the house orchestra. So probably more musicians on stage than ever before in Las Vegas. And so it was a big, big show, and in a big showroom. And that was something new for Vegas, and I think kind of pointed the way toward what Vegas would later become.
I love this book. It's absolutely fascinating. It's called Elvis in Vegas: How the King Reinvented the Las Vegas Show. And the author, my guest, Richard Zoglin. Richard Zoglin, thank you so much for spending some time talking about this book.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.